consequences of the research?
Fiona, thank you for what was a very long and exceptionally generous introduction. I think if I'd seen it before, I would have made you chop that in half, but I didn't see it before, and you'll have to forgive me some of the repeats that I make when I talk about Joseph Fisher. But first of all, it is an absolute privilege to be here this evening, and I am very grateful to Adelaide University for the honour of delivering the 2026 Joseph Fisher Public Lecture. I begin by acknowledging the traditional owners and custodians of the land on which we meet, the Kaurna people, and by paying my respects to elders past and present. Joseph Fisher was, as you have already been told, a businessman, a parliamentarian, a philanthropist who understood that economics at its best is a public good. Fisher's legacy in South Australia and nationally was grounded in a profound sense of public responsibility and a conviction that economic thinking should serve society, inform policy, and be tested in the real world. It's fitting that this lecture invites reflection not just on economic ideas, but on how those ideas are formed, how they are challenged, and ultimately how they are applied over time. Speaking here tonight, I want to reflect on what I have learnt and what Fisher's journey teaches about economic leadership and public responsibility, and about how institutions like universities, boards, and central banks think and operate. I also want to consider how today's economic challenges differ from, but in some cases echo, those of the past. Economic thinking still matters profoundly, and its connection to public purpose is no less important today than it was in Joseph Fisher's time. Fisher's story is one of conviction, joined with a very generous spirit and of intellect placed firmly in the service of the public good. Arriving in South Australia at a formative moment in its history, he quickly recognised that prosperity depended not only on enterprise, but on education, fairness, and informed public debate. He was a commercial leader and a reformer, and above all, a citizen who believed deeply in responsibility beyond self-interest. He understood that commerce and public and commercial institutions should contribute to social stability. His work as a banker and a company director, including his service on the board of the Bank of Adelaide, reflected a belief that businesses and markets must operate within moral boundaries, and that trust in institutions is earned through independence of judgment and integrity in decision making. Fisher also understood that institutions that endure are built not only in parliaments and boardrooms, but across civic life more generally. His endowments explicitly call out commerce, civilization, social responsibility, and the human consequence of moral choices. This evening, I will draw on Fisher's legacy as a lens through which to reflect on economic leadership and how institutions make decisions under uncertainty, and on what that means for monetary policy today. It has been mentioned that I am a follower of the mighty Adelaide Crows. They run deep in my veins. I wasn't sure about alluding to have resilience or longevity, but I do often reflect on the role that sport plays in shaping shared standards, identity, and trust. It's no coincidence that Fisher devoted decades to the administration of cricket in this state. He understood that whether an institution is financial, political, or sporting, it carries an obligation to the community that it serves. As a member of the Reserve Bank's Monetary Policy Board, that obligation to the Australian community is one that I take seriously. The board's decisions are often complex, frequently contested, and rarely comfortable. That they must always be grounded in evidence, guided by independence, and directed towards the public interest. That standard of responsibility reflects something Joseph Fisher understood well. His insistence that economic knowledge be rigorous, widely shared, and tested in practice speaks directly to the demands of economic governance today. His endowment of this university was not an act of prestige and was not explicitly focused on profit or finance, but an investment in future generations, in people of character and social responsibility who would be asked to make difficult decisions on behalf of the community. In that sense, this lecture carries forward his quiet challenge to think carefully, to act responsibly, and place long-term public benefit above short-term gain. That challenge has pretty much shaped my own professional life. I have been fortunate to work in financial centres and boardrooms across cities and continents far from home. Yet Adelaide has always remained the place to which it all connects. The responsibility to act in the interests of the community rather than narrow advantage sits at the heart of how I think about economic leadership today. In monetary policy, economic thinking is translated into public outcomes that matter to households, to businesses and communities across the country. At the centre of responsibility sits what is often referred to as the RBA's dual mandate. Australia's framework for monetary policy is deliberately anchored in public purpose. The RBA is charged with supporting one, low and stable inflation, and two, a high level of employment as part of a broader obligation to promote the economic welfare of the Australian people, not just today, but over time. That pairing of low and stable inflation and full employment is often misunderstood as a compromise between competing goals. In fact, it reflects a long-standing insight in economics that prosperity is not sustained by price stability alone, nor by employment outcomes in isolation, but by the interaction between the two. Over the longer term, price stability makes a central contribution to the economic prosperity and welfare of Australian people. When inflation is low and stable, households can plan, businesses can invest, and institutions can make decisions with greater confidence and focus their efforts on productive activities. That environment helps to support innovation, capital formation, and ultimately jobs. Price stability and full employment are therefore complementary and not competing objectives over the long term. The challenge is that the economy does not always behave smoothly or predictably. Over short periods, shocks can disrupt this balance. Supply constraints push inflation higher at the very same time that they weaken economic activity and employment. These moments test institutions like the RBA, not because their goals have changed, but because achieving them and achieving both elements of the RBA's dual mandate becomes much more complex. It's often said that central banks face a stark choice in such moments between prioritising inflation or prioritising jobs. But for those of us responsible for policy, that framing misses the point. It's not a question of which objective matters the most. Instead, it's about understanding that generally they are complementary over the longer term. Seen this way, the RBA's dual mandate is an expression of economics in service of the broader public interest. It recognises that the technical expertise must be guided by judgment, that independence carries responsibility, and that trust is built when institutions act consistently with the long-term interests of Australians. The challenge, then, is translating those principles into decisions particularly when the economic environment is uncertain, the data are incomplete, and the consequences matter deeply for households and businesses. That is where governance, process, and judgment come together. So turning now from principles to practice, I want to talk about how those values, governance, process, and judgment are brought to life in the work of the Monetary Policy Board. Every decision that we make is grounded in disciplined and searching a briefing process. Ahead of each meeting, board members consider a substantial body of material prepared by RBA staff, and during each meeting, there is significant time devoted to discussion, challenge, and differing perspectives. We are briefed directly by senior executives, including Dr. Sarah Hunter, who is the assistant governor who briefs on economic, who presents economic analysis and forecasts, including how monetary policy is affecting economic behaviour. And we are briefed by Dr. Christopher Kent, assistant governor from the Financial Markets Group. Tonight, I'm going to focus on the financial markets elements of these briefings. The presentation at each meeting by Dr. Kent covers developments in global and domestic financial markets, including interest rates, bonds and equity markets, exchange rates, funding conditions, and credit. Importantly, these developments are framed around questions that matter for monetary policy, including how financial conditions are evolving, how markets are interpreting economic data, and how policy decisions are likely to be transmitted through the financial system to the economy. In the context of the board's deliberations, developments in short-term interest rates are a natural starting point for our discussions on financial conditions. Market expectations at the short end of the yield curve reflect how participants are interpreting current conditions and anticipating future policy settings. Those expectations matter because monetary policy works not only through the current cash rate, but through expectations of future rates that influence longer-term borrowing, borrowing costs, asset prices, exchange rates, and financial conditions more broadly. We watch how government bond markets, particularly at longer maturities, provide further insight into how markets view the persistence of inflation and the outlook for growth. The shape of the yield curve can offer signals about momentum in the economy and the balance of risks while also highlighting uncertainty. These signals are never decisive on their own, but they form an important part of the overall assessment. We watch closely corporate bond spreads and equity markets as they provide insight into risk appetite, financing conditions, and profit expectations. Movements in these markets can influence firms' access to funding and affect decisions about investment, hiring, and output. They also help indicate whether financial conditions are tightening or easing in ways that may reinforce or offset the intended purpose of policy. The exchange rate is another important element in the transmission, particularly in a small open economy like Australia. Changes in the exchange rate affect import prices, export competitiveness, reflect temporary volatility or more persistent shifts in fundamentals, like differences in interest rates here and offshore or commodity prices. All those are crucial for assessing their implications for inflation and activity. Bank funding costs and lending rates also matter because they determine how changes in the cash rate pass through to households and businesses. Monitoring developments in wholesale funding markets and the extent of pass-through to mortgage and business lending rates helps the board assess the extent to which monetary policy is working as intended. It also provides insight into the resilience and functioning of the financial system. Credit growth and credit availability offer further perspective on how policy is affecting behaviour. Developments in household and business borrowing shed light on confidence, balance sheet positions, and spending capabilities. The board also pays close attention to the composition of lending, including which lenders or markets are providing new forms of funding to ensure that risks are not building in some corners of the financial system. Taken together, these indicators help us understand current economic conditions and how expectations are forming about where they might be headed. One way in which monetary policy affects Australians directly is through household cash flows. Changes in interest rates alter mortgage payments, as I'm sure so many know, and other debt servicing costs. They influence disposable income and spending decisions. The board considers these effects in aggregate, but also how those effects are distributed across households, recognising differences in debt levels, in incomes, savings buffers, and loan structures. But despite the salience of the cash flow channel, transmission of monetary policy also occurs through its effects on savings and investment behaviour and its effect on asset prices. These are the so-called intertemporal channels and wealth channels of monetary policy transmission, which are important even if they are more difficult to quantify. To bring all that together, the board assesses whether monetary stance is expansionary, neutral, or restrictive, and whether it will achieve our mandate. Concepts like the neutral exchange rate, that neither grows nor restricts the economy, provide useful reference points for assessing the stance of policy, but they are inherently uncertain. For that reason, assessments of policy restrictiveness are made as part of a broader evaluation of financial conditions, encompassing interest rates, credit availability, asset prices, exchange rate, and the observed behaviour in the economy. Early in my career, I began working in markets during a period of Australian financial deregulation in the 1980s. When the float of the Australian dollar and the entry of foreign banks were fundamentally reshaping the system. Experiencing that transition firsthand taught me that market structures matter and that policy assumptions are always tested and often revised by changing conditions. That experience reinforced through later roles in risk management and governance and left me acutely aware that while economic models are helpful framing devices, you actually can't use them to analyse your ways out of uncertainty. Managing uncertainty under real constraints made judgment a discipline rather than just an abstraction, and that lesson has stayed with me. This was especially true more than two decades later when during the global financial crisis, when the speed and severity of the crisis that spread from the United States caused significant uncertainty and disruption in global financial markets. As chair of Westpac's risk committee at the time, the importance of judgments and judgments in all ways, particularly then to avoid exposure to risky financial instruments, provided me with a practical example of managing this kind of uncertainty in a real world. When dealing with uncertainty, the Reserve Bank Board does not consider models or market intelligence in isolation. Financial markets move quickly and can be noisy, and what matters just as much is what we hear direct from the real economy. Indeed, one of the Reserve Bank's distinctive strengths is its long-standing business and community liaison program. Every single month, RBA staff speak regularly with various businesses across regions and industries, as well as with unions, communities, organisations and economists in the private sector. These conversations provide timely insights into hiring, investment pricing, costs and confidence that are often difficult to capture fully in official statistics. As Governor Bullock has emphasised, monetary policy is stronger when it is informed by real-world experience, not solely by models or market pricing. For me, the liaison program plays a crucial role in testing assumptions and assessing whether the story told by the data aligns with what firms and households are experiencing on the ground. Listening also matters inside the Reserve Bank, and one of the key recommendations from the relatively recent Reserve Bank review was that the board hear from a wider range of staff perspectives. Engaging directly with the RBA staff from across the organisation who are responsible for the analytical work through briefings and policy discussions ahead of board decisions has deepened our understanding of many of the important issues facing the economy. Importantly, doing so has reinforced the need to hear diverse views and engage in debate. All of this analysis, intelligence, and listening serves a single purpose: forming considered judgments in an uncertain and changing world. I'm often asked, what is the most important role of the Monetary Policy Board? For me, it is the formation of sound, credible judgment. Those judgments matter most when the global environment is particularly unsettled, as it is today. While uncertainty is not new, the economic context in which we are operating is very different from the one that shaped policy thinking during the global oil crisis of the 70s. Understanding the differences between the 70s global oil crisis and today is essential to sound monetary policy, particularly in how we assess inflation, shocks, and economic resilience. My perspective on this has been shaped not only by institutional experience, but also by personal history. It begins in the late 70s. My postgraduate studies at Cambridge coincided with a period of exceptional economic turbulence. In the United Kingdom, I arrived in the late 70s when inflation, having reached extraordinary levels earlier in the decade, remained persistently high. Very weak productivity growth, large fiscal deficits, and fragile confidence shape daily economic life. Pressures on wages, prices, and the currency culminated in widespread industrial disruption during the so-called winter of discontent, exactly when I was there, 78 and 79. That period left a lasting impression on me. It was my first direct exposure to the power of inflationary expectations and to the profound economic and social costs that arise when inflationary expectations become entrenched. Academically, those years also broadened my exposure to global economic thinking, particularly in finance and banking. I was fortunate to learn from economists such as Joan Robinson, a close intellectual collaborator of John Maynard Keynes, whose work stressed the importance of institutions in shaping competition, aggregate demand, and income distribution, and Phyllis Dean, who underscored the central role of history and context in economic analysis. That environment deepened my interest in macroeconomic policy, even if at the time I had no sense of all where that interest might lead. My subsequent career unfolded alongside transformations that followed. I entered financial markets in Australia at a moment when economics moved decisively from textbook abstraction to lived reality. What I had studied in lectures and seminars was in fact playing out in real time through prices, balance sheets, and policy choices. Beginning my professional life in Australia in banking and risk management during the 80s and early 90s meant learning to think about trade-offs, incentives, and uncertainties, not as theories, but as forces with real consequences. Those lessons were later reinforced through board roles, periods of crisis and governance responsibilities, settings where judgment mattered most, and where the costs of getting it wrong were born not in models, but by people. Over time, this brought a sharper focus to the critical role that institutions play in supporting sound judgment, particularly in the context of a financial system as interconnected globally as Australia's. This is reflected in the way Australia's financial system has been built. Its resilience rests on a coordinated and well-calibrated regulatory architecture that has evolved over many decades. In 2014, I joined David Murray on the panel of the Financial System Inquiry, commonly referred to as the Murray Inquiry. The inquiry was not simply concerned with profit or efficiency. It deliberately took a broad view of what a well-functioning system should achieve and how it could be strengthened, motivated by what best served the public good. While the inquiry preceded my appointment by a long way to the then Reserve Bank Board, it provided a valuable perspective across many aspects of the RBA's broader remit beyond monetary policy. This included payments, financial stability, and importantly, the role of the financial system in supporting economic growth, productivity, and innovation. The inquiry sought to reduce the risk of systemic collapse by ensuring commercial banks are unquestionably strong, with an eye to macroeconomic stability. It also aimed to deepen prudential oversight and build resilience into the system. It addressed the distortions associated with institutions perceived as too big to fail. At the same time, it placed fairness and consumer outcomes at the center of public policy. This included improving financial advice, safeguarding household savings, and providing. Where did I get to? Sorry. Savings and clarifying the role of the superannuation system to provide income to Australians in retirement. The objective was to create a system that is stable, trusted, competitive, and innovative, one that gives households and businesses reliable access to the financial services that they need to plan with confidence while supporting the broader economy by providing credit that enables investment growth and long-term prosperity. For central banks, a system with these features is highly desirable. By supporting growth in the economy's productive capacity, it allows for higher employment without creating inflation pressures. A stable financial system is essential for effective monetary policy transmission, particularly when policy adjustments are needed. But institutions alone do not explain the difference between then and now. To understand today's economic and policy challenges, it's important to recognize how much has changed from the last oil shock. The broad policy framework has evolved significantly. Central bank independence is stronger, mandates for low and stable inflation are clearer, financial markets are deeper, and regulatory frameworks are more robust. At the same time, the structure of the economy has shifted in important ways, and so has the role of energy, especially oil. In the 70s, oil was central to production and transport. Energy use per unit of output was far higher than it is today, and the oil price shocks fed very quickly and powerfully into inflation across almost every sector of the economy. When oil prices rose sharply, inflation rose with them and remained elevated. Reinforced by adaptive expectations and institutional arrangements that struggled to break inflationary momentum. Today, the Australian economy is far less oil intensive. It doesn't mean that fuel prices no longer matter, far from it. Higher petrol and diesel prices still affect household budgets and business costs and are immediately visible to the community. But improvements in energy efficiency, technological change, and shifts in the structure of the economy mean energy now represents a smaller share of overall spending by businesses and households. Fuel price increases tend to add to inflation in the short term, but they are less likely to dominate inflation outcomes the way they once did. Related to this is a broader structural adjustment. The shocks of the 70s forced economies to adapt. Over time, many countries diversified their energy sources, invested in efficiency, and reduced oil's centrality to economic activity. Energy still matters, but oil no longer sits at the very core of macroeconomic stability. That shift has helped make economies more flexible and less vulnerable to disruptions from a single source of supply, a perspective that is particularly relevant when assessing today's geopolitical shocks. These structural changes are highly relevant in considering the economic effects of the current conflicts in the Middle East. The war has disrupted energy production and shipping in the region, driving sharp increases in global prices for oil, liquefied natural gas, and other key commodities such as fertilizers. As a result, inflation here in Australia has lifted, building on inflationary pressures that were already building ahead of the war. Based on what we know so far, the RBA staff assess that oil prices will weigh only moderately on economic activity. However, I emphasize this, the outlook depends on the duration and the severity of the disruption and how households and businesses respond. The fuel price increases seen so far imply a modest impact on real incomes for a typical household, though that impact is uneven and certainly more acute for some than for others. Energy commodities nevertheless remain important to Australia's economy. While we are a net exporter of energy overall, we rely on imports of crude oil and refined petroleum products. Most industries use fuel as an input, particularly diesel, with transport, mining, and agriculture accounting for a large share of the business fuel use. And around 90% of diesel consumption is by businesses, while households consume more petrol directly. Gas is another key domestic energy source, and again, Australia is a net exporter. High energy prices therefore affect inflation both directly through fuel and utility prices, indirectly through higher transport and production costs. Over time, there is also the risk of second round effects if elevated fuel prices begin to influence inflationary expectations or wage bargaining, particularly if price increases are large or sustained. Assessing whether that is occurring is an important part of the Monetary Policy Board's current deliberations. Inflation expectations are better when they are anchored. Policy credibility is stronger. Wage setting arrangements are more decentralised and flexible. Australia's floating exchange rate now acts as a buffer, absorbing part of the impact of global shocks rather than transmitting them directly into domestic inflation or activity. We need to hold those structural gains. None of this means shocks no longer matter or that adjustment is painless, but it does mean we are not confronting uncertainty without some guardrails. The framework within which monetary policy operates today provides greater resilience and clearer basis for judgments. Taken together, these experiences and structural changes shape how I assess the current economic conditions and risks. They reinforce the importance of judgment, of curiosity paired with humility, and of drawing on diverse perspectives in an environment of elevated global uncertainty. All those qualities are not optional. They are essential to deliver on the RBA's mandate and to support the long-term economic welfare of Australians. So, as I end, it feels especially fitting that my journey in economics began here at the University of Adelaide in the mid-1970s, during years that proved formative in shaping both my intellectual interests and my professional direction. Those studies sparked a lifelong engagement with financial systems, market structures, and public policy, and with a central question that has now run through my career ever since. How can scarce resources be allocated in ways that support prosperity, resilience, and the public good? Returning here tonight is for me an opportunity to say thank you. Thank you to an institution and to academic staff who instilled a respect for evidence history and public purpose, and who demonstrated that economics, when practiced with rigour, curiosity and humility, can make a genuine contribution to society. Equally important were the people. I was fortunate to learn from a remarkable group of academics whose influence extended well beyond the lecture theatre: Jeff Harcourt, Eric Russell, Kevin Davis, Mervyn Lewis, my honours supervisor Bob Lindner, John Hatch, David Round and Ian McLean may not be familiar to everyone here this evening, but their contribution to Australian and global economic thinking has been substantial and enduring. What united them was not one view or unanimity, but a shared commitment to rigorous thinking in the public interest. Some of them were shaped by a globally recognised Cambridge-influenced tradition of macroeconomic thought. Others went on to make a lasting contribution to money and banking, competition policy, labour policy and regulation. Together they fostered intellectual curiosity, disciplined reasoning and a deep respect for constructive disagreement. It was Jeff Harcourt who encouraged me to continue my postgraduate studies at Cambridge, and in doing so, profoundly shaped my path. If there was one message I would leave with the academics and lecturers here tonight, and I have had the privilege of speaking to a number of you earlier today, it is this: your inspiration matters. It can change lives in ways you may never fully appreciate. This faculty, through its commitment to rigorous and public-minded economics, changed mine. Joseph Fisher understood that truth deeply. His legacy reminds us that ideas matter, institutions matter, and education matters. Not for prestige or abstraction, but because they shape decisions made on behalf of the community. In an uncertain world, that responsibility endures. It's a responsibility I am grateful to have learned here, and one that I continue to carry with me today. In carrying it forward, we honour both Joseph Fisher's legacy and the enduring public purpose of economics itself. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you for that. It was, I found it very interesting, and I really appreciate many of the points that you raised. Now, I'm going to remind people this is a public lecture, so we will be going to the audience for questions that you would want to put forward. I'm going to start off while you're thinking and ask you, you talk a lot about public goods, and you ended with the public goods, and you have a question mark on the end of public good up there. I'm not quite sure. But, yeah.
Focused on that,
but the idea that, you know, the RBA anchors in public purpose, you said, and the decisions, and we need to have policy credibility going forward and having an impact. Yet we see a growing kind of skepticism among the public in institutions, in governments, in policy, in the ability for it to make their lives, you know, better. I'm wondering, where do you think this kind of skepticism comes from? And do you see a way where, you know, we might be able to help provide better understanding among the public?
Thanks, Susan. One of the reasons I wanted to talk about the Reserve Bank's dual mandate is I don't think it's well understood that the Reserve Bank is trying to balance over the longer term a desire for low and stable inflation and full employment. And I think that's often missed with that constant focus on getting inflation down, pushing interest rates up to get inflation down. It confuses people and it's difficult to understand, but the dual mandate is something that I think is particularly important for people to understand. And part of what we're doing now with Reserve Bank board members
now obliged, I have to tell you, to make one public decent speech a year. Take a big deep breath. It is something that I think we have an obligation to educate the broader community on what we are trying to do with that dual mandate. And the dual mandate, the low and stable inflation, is indeed a public good that enables households to provide some degree of certainty. It allows businesses to invest. It enables people to make good judgments about saving and their investments. All of that is a good public good. Full employment has at least a public characteristic to that. When people have jobs, they are better placed to support their families. And we are in a better place as a society if people have a job. It was that that I was particularly keen to know. So I think the onus is on us to do it well. And I must say, I want to congratulate Governor Bullock on her press conferences now as part of this after Reserve Bank decisions. She is exceptionally good at trying to explain what we hope will happen with an increase in interest rates, notwithstanding that makes mortgage payers pay more, and there are elements of issues for businesses with higher interest rates, but on the other side, saving and investment. And the issue that I'll finish on this, low and stable inflation helps support prosperity, and that is most, and purchasing power, that is most important for the vulnerable people in our society. So that is the public good as well.
Agree completely. Any questions? Yes. I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt one second. Could you please state who you are and what your organization or what you represent?
Yep, Phil Kalogeras, and I'm a postgrad student in economics after a career elsewhere. So two parts. Firstly, if the government resumes your property for the public good, one is constitutionally entitled to just recompense. Shouldn't the same be true if one is conscripted into unemployment to keep inflation down? And the second part is, we have been having a lot of discussions about resilience lately against a concept of, against a concept of efficiency, but we never split out the insurance aspect of resilience and say, this is the cost of running this business efficiently, but this is the cost, the insurance cost to the country if we maintain this facility, infrastructure, whatever, for the public good or for resilience.
I should have had my pen with me to write down the questions as you were going. The first question was, if the government resumes your property, you should get some recompense. And
scripted into unemployment.
I really tried to make the point in the speech that conscripting to unemployment is not the mandate of the Reserve Bank. In fact, it's the opposite. It is attempting to maintain as full employment as possible at the same time as reducing inflation. And I'm going to make the same point again, that if inflation and inflation expectations take off, they are more hurtful to the economy at large and particularly vulnerable people than if we can monitor and keep inflation and reduce aggregate demand appropriately. And so I just said it is not the intention of the Reserve Bank ever to conscript people to unemployment. Our mandate is quite the opposite. And then your second question was on insurance?
In talking about resilience, we often lose out on the efficiency side. We don't, top of mind at the moment is we haven't got a refining capability here because it's more efficient to have them overseas, but we need national infrastructure. So why isn't the conversation about this is the efficient economic cost of this but there's going to be an insurance cost aspect that is separate as a separate discussion. Otherwise, we're always going to lose out to...
I understand your issue. That is an issue for government, not the Reserve Bank. We don't have the mandate to really... We have one mechanism, interest rates up and down, to impact on aggregate demand and supply. So I think that's a question that would be better handled by government as distinct from me at the Reserve Bank. I'm sorry.
Did I see a... Okay. Did I see a question over here?
Hello. My name's Penny Stevens. I'm an economics graduate from the 70s, from this university as well. My question's about the headline inflation rate. The RBA is often criticised for having a much higher headline inflation rate than many other major central banks. I did notice today that the latest figures that were published show a marginal drop to 4.2%. But it is still a lot higher than other countries. A quick Google search shows that the Europe area is at 3%, New Zealand's at 3.1%, and the United Kingdom and Canada at 2.8%. My question is, why is ours so much higher? Is it because the RBA was not aggressive enough earlier on in lifting the interest rates, or is it because the government is not reducing its expenditure, in other words, spending too much money? Who is to blame?
Thank you. It is a question that's often asked, and we are, as the Reserve Bank, often criticised for having a headline rate higher than others. There are two points I'd like to make. Our target for the cash rate, our target is 2.5%, halfway between 2 and 3%. A number of other investment central banks have targets lower than ours. So, for example, Federal Reserve has a target of 2, the ECB has a target of 2, the Bank of England has a target of 2%. So we have a higher target, so you might expect us to have perhaps a higher headline rate. But the other really important reason or comment is that we have the dual mandate. So you will find that in fighting inflation, if we go back over the last 18 months, Australia did not raise its rates as high as many of these other countries. We were balancing the long-term desire to have full employment with inflation. So while our unemployment rate is at the monthly rate was 4.2 today, it sits around somewhere between 4.2 and 4.6 most recently. But you'll find the ECB has an unemployment rate of 6.2. So they are, that balance between labour markets and inflation explains some of the difference in the headline rate. So the Bank of England unemployment rate is 5%. The Bank of Canada is 6.9%. And while they have their lower headline inflation, they have higher rates of unemployment. And I think that dual mandate goes a long way to explaining how we've tried to manage inflation over the last 18 months versus some of the other countries.
Michael Scoble. I'm retired, so I have no one to blame. Joe Hockey made the comment yesterday at National Press Club. He sees the unemployment rate at 15% by 2030, and the Financial Review made a comment earlier this week saying youth unemployment running at 11%. So it's pretty high. What are your thoughts on all those figures?
Well, they certainly won't be a target. They're certainly going to be out there. Every move and every decision the Reserve Bank makes will be trying to balance the unemployment rate with the inflation rate. and aiming for a low and stable inflation rate will be the most important thing in giving confidence to the community and society to be able to continue to have the confidence to employ people. So I didn't hear those comments. They're quite shocking. They're certainly not in the forecasts, and they're not something that I would see as reasonable at all.
Okay. Questions? Fiona?
Carolyn, if I may change the question tenor so far, what advice would you give to our female colleagues and women in public, in either public sphere, in academia, in government, or in corporate Australia? What three things do you think we should be doing that will make sure that they are able to succeed maybe a third of what you've done?
My advice will probably be pretty much the same as I would say to the men. It is to put your head down, work hard, find areas where you can make a difference, and give of your all to making the most of your life. I'm struggling with the question and whether the answer should be different for women, because I see women making giant strides in so many areas. And I remember sitting in this, not this lecture theatre, but a lecture theatre at the University of Adelaide in the early 1970s. And I think we had sort of maybe 20 of 350 women, and men dominated dramatically in first year economics. Over that period, the advice that I would have given myself would be the same as the men. I've seen a lot of women succeed, and I've seen a lot of men succeed. And I think my message is to really understand what you are trying to achieve. Understand the drivers of your business. Understand your purpose in a business. Understand your purpose in life. Work out what you want from your life. That wouldn't be a different answer to men. I would also say that women shouldn't try to mirror men and their behaviours. I would say be bold and be yourself. But I would say that to men too. I think there's a message to men these days about backing themselves as well, just as women. So I'm struggling with my answer. It would have been a different answer 20 years ago. I had a different answer for women then who were probably more struggling to make their way in the working field. But I think I am not going to draw great distinctions today. I met today your PhD students, and the women were exceptional, the men were exceptional, what they study is outstanding. And so my message to them today was have humility as you go forward. Be prepared to back yourselves in what you do. Learn your priorities, your tasks, your drivers. And it was the same message to both.
I think we had a question in the back, right? Oh, we had two.
Hi, my name's George Gardner. I'm a high school economics teacher. And I guess my question was around the fact that we see falling student numbers across the country in economics, certainly at a secondary level. I'm not so sure at a tertiary level. And I wondered if you had a view on why there perhaps seems to be less engagement with economic ideas, and given the importance of it to economics being able to be a public good, if you had any thoughts on how we might turn that around.
There was a similar question today at the university level. What is it about economics that is not attracting as many students and followers in the past? And I think there are a number of things that I would say. Economics has been cornered or wedged into now being described as an abstract theoretical discipline that's very mathematical. And I think sometimes that makes it hard for employers to understand where economists fit. But I came back very quickly and strongly in my thinking today to say, economists have a way of thinking that is useful across disciplines, right through organizations, whether they be for-profit or not-for-profit. And if we could begin talking about economics as a way of thinking and looking at economic measures that are so valuable for a cross purpose. So for example, the allocation of scarce resources, understanding trade-offs, understanding how incentives work, understanding what opportunity cost in, they're all economic measures that are valid right across all industries and purposes. And I think if we can begin talking like that and being able to find ways that people understand what economists do. There was another really, I think, interesting point today. The World Economic Forum has come out with which jobs in which order, which 10 jobs in which order, will best withstand the AI momentum. And the top one, I think it was today, and there might be people in the room who have this statistic better than I do, was data analytics. And I had just sat in the room with the PhD students, and one after the other, econometrician, data analytics, econometrician, data. That's the way we need to start talking about what economists do. Their data analytics capability is extraordinary. But jobs aren't advertised for economists. They are advertised for data analytics. And I think economists have to get better at explaining what they do and why they fit that requirement. And that's the same for other jobs that will be impacted by AI and how economists describe what they're actually good at and thinking about all those economic measures that they put into practice.
And there was another question in the back.
Hello, good night. My name is Emiliano Carlivaro. I'm staff at the School of Economics. I have a little bit of question about financial regulation. You were explaining the importance of financial markets in general and banking in the transmission of the decision monetary policy. Given in Australia that APRA is separated from the central bank, how is the coordination with APRA in terms of transmission and whether, well, you explained it correctly, they might offset what the central bank is trying to do?
I'm very happy to say that we have a organization that brings the three major regulators together, APRA, the Reserve Bank, and ASIC together as central bank. Chaired by the governor of the central bank. And the dialogue and the discussion and the understanding of the issues and trying to preempt issues is extremely good in Australia. It's one of the things that we do very, very well.
Do you want to explain what the other two? RBA, I think everybody knows, but they might not be as familiar with APRA and ASIC.
Good evening, and thank you so much for your incredible insights. Very generous tonight. I'm just interested to know, on the point of data analytics and so forth, what do you have any wishes or things that would change in terms of the data insights and analytics that you receive to make, you know, future-focused insights and decisions for the country and the work that you and the board do?
I'm so sorry, I'm going to relay that back to you because I'm not sure I heard it properly. But is it the question, what data analytics could we as a Reserve Bank benefit from and data analytics to do our job better? Was that the question?
Yes, if there's any changes that you would wish for.
One of the things that I'm learning is how important models are, how complex they are, how deciphering models and their different signals is important. And then I overlay that by saying one of the greatest things that we can do is bring our judgment to this. But let me give you an example, perhaps in different areas. One of the things that I find most useful that the Reserve Bank does very well is summarize central bank behavior and experiences from around the world. Because at times, other central banks precede us with rising of interest rates or cutting interest rates or understanding the regulations that are there. Data analytics can summarize for us, it's AI really, I guess, can do a wonderful job in analyzing those, that momentum, where the pressures are coming from, how we might behave differently. So I think there's information that we look at that can be monitored more efficiently with additional data analytics. And that covers everything from how bond markets are moving to how bond spreads are moving, to how unemployment rates are moving around the rest of the world, how exchange rates are moving, really across all those areas that we look at, I think data analytics could be better used and employed.
Other questions? Oh, all the way in the back.
Thank you. My name is Mimi Salmina. I'm a PhD student in the School of Economics. It is interesting when you are saying that it is more important to hearing direct experiences from business and general society than relying on economic modeling when deciding, when making a decisions. But I see that somehow there is often different perspective, different interest between two different parties, let's say between businesses and a community in terms of salary to maintain employment. For example, a business maintain the, let's say, current salary rate, but then the community or the household tend to have intentions to increase the salary to get better welfare. So when you're facing the situations like different perspective from different two key stakeholders in economics, what the solutions that usually, what's the mechanisms that you usually take to deal with the issues in economics? Thank you.
Thank you. I think one of the things that I didn't make very clear was the Reserve Bank liaison teams speak to all elements of the community, not just business, not-for-profit organizations. It's difficult, we're not really talking to individuals, but right across the board. And the data, the models, tends to be slower to give us good signals. It tends to be aggregated over a longer period of time. And what we do get from the Reserve Bank liaison team is faster, preemptive, to say this is happening in the community. And it may well be that businesses are hiring, are having to pay higher rates, are not hiring, are finding that they need to cut costs, that unemployment is increasing in this sector. And we get that very immediately, and it could, and it works both ways, and it's not just for-profit feedback that we get. I hope that addresses the question.
Well, Sally, I think we're going to have to end it there, but I'd like to give my personal thanks to everyone and the great participation and questions that we had. And I'm going to invite Fiona up to provide a gift.
Very short.
On of appreciation from the university.
Thank you, Carolyn, for your generous discussion here, your time, your effort. It's been tremendously insightful, and thank you. On behalf of the school and the university, I also wish to thank the audience. Thank you for your support and engagement. We are proud to contribute to these national and important conversations, and grateful to all of you, alongside with my colleagues, that you are able to join us for these events. Carolyn?
A small token of appreciation. You know, I would have done it for nothing.
Unfortunately, I think we are making sure you're doing it for nothing.
Thank you. Oh, yeah, I've not been paid. Thank you. That looks lovely. Thank you very much.
Small, very small token.
It's an absolute pleasure. It's an honor to be here back at the Adelaide University, at University of Adelaide. And thank you all for listening. I appreciate it.